you know, because I have to keep going back and back and back. But this is the directions. It tells me how to get into it. The prayer that I absolutely is my favorite prayer, and it's the prayer of St. Francis of Assisi. I've got it all over my house. I've got gifts, which I absolutely love. I've got four of them out in my backyard in California. One of the nice things about California is the beauty, of course. And I have the prettiest backyard that you have. I mean, I got flowers out there. It reminds me of breakfast. I don't know what they are. You know, I have no earthly idea what they are. And they're magnificent. And I have three St. Francis out there, just planted right in the middle of all that gorgeous stuff. And it is the most wonderful place to sit with a cup of coffee and look at my day. It's nice. I have a girl that I sponsor, and she just, you know, she just wears me out. She's just one of those that just, and she's got, somebody identifies, huh, Betty? Yeah. And everything you tell you, she's got 10 things that why it ain't going to work. She'll have 10 years. I think in 2 more weeks, she's going to have 10 magnificent years in this program. And she said to me, this was a few years ago. At that time, I had a beautiful place that I got up in the morning and had my coffee, and it was a big, beautiful bay window and the plants and the trees, and it was gorgeous. And she said, well, you've got all that stuff again. Now I don't have nothing. I just leave this apartment. I look out my window, and I see a bowl, and it's just, you know, one of those. I said, why don't you do this, Debbie? Why don't you go to your kitchen, get a bowl, put some water in it, grab a leaf off the tree, throw it in there, and watch the damn thing float, you know? It does not matter where you're at. It doesn't matter what position you're at. It matters that you're doing it, discovered I. So this is the prayer that, I mean, is so meaningful in my life. When I am really down and out, when something's happened that I don't know what to do, when I'm discouraged and I don't know why, when I'm tired and I don't know why, when my husband has hurt my feelings so bad I can't hardly hold my head up and I don't know why, and or do know why, when I'm tired and I don't want to get up and do anything, this, I mean, it's just like a bolt of electricity to me. Lord, make me a channel of thy peace, that where there is hatred, I may bring love, that where there is wrong, I may bring the spirit of forgiveness, that where there is discord, I may bring harmony, that where there is error, I may bring truth, that where there is doubt, I may bring faith, where there is despair, I may bring hope, that where there are shadows, I may bring light, that where there is sadness, I may bring joy. Lord, grant that I may seek rather to comfort than be comforted, to understand than to be understood, to love than to be loved. For it is by self-forgetting that one finds, it is by forgiving that one is forgiven. It is dying that one awakens to eternal life. There hadn't been a line in that thing that hadn't jumped up me at one point or the other. And I've read it a jillion times. Now, I've heard some girls talking about their relationships. How do you have a relationship? You know, how do you get prepared for that wonderful, magnificent man that's going to be in your life? And I was told a long time ago to look at this prayer and to become it, to put it on my shoes and walk it, and that I would become then exactly what I needed. I would become loving. I would become someone rather to love and be loved, to comfort and be comforted. And that would draw to me this kind of a person. I think I missed. Just kidding. He's wonderful. So what I need from a man, what I need from you, I try to become. And this is the directions. This 11-step prayer is the direction for me. When I'm hurt about something, it shows me in here. It's maybe I am in despair. Maybe I'm in despair over something, which I certainly have been from time to time. And maybe there's a shadow in my life. It tells me one more time, as long as I'm looking here, it ain't going to work. If I take it down and look at you, it's going to work. It has always been that way. If I'll just tend to Sunday, if I will just tend to Sunday's business and stay under the umbrella of grace, then God's going to take care of Monday and Thursday and Wednesday and all those things. And all I have to do is this. Why don't I tend to Sunday and look at you and see what's happened with you today? And it brings me out every time. I am absolutely, of course, no expert on prayer and meditation. My prayers have changed so many times. I've gotten what I do down to a little, my own personal thing, and what you do is your own journey, of course, and it's what you have to do, of course. But I have done this enough that I know what's comforting for me, and I change it from time to time, but most of it goes like this. In the morning, upon awakening, I say the first three steps in prayer form. I say the third step prayer, kind of in my own words. I say part of that seven-step prayer. Then I do read. I get up. This has been a commitment off and on for me through the years. It depends on what's going on in my life. My commitment again is now to get out of that bed and roll over on those knees. God doesn't need it. I need it. And I get up off those knees and I go get my coffee. And or sometimes my husband does the most precious thing for me. He always has my coffee made. And most times brings it to me. I have three books that I read. I read out of the big book. I read the instructions because it reminds me what I'm supposed to think about today and what I'm doing. I have the One Day Time book. I have God Calling. It is not Conference Proof, but it's God Calling. It's one of the most precious books. Those of you who read the little 24-hour book of, a lot of AAs read that, a lot of God Callings put in there. And I've been given one that has been added to me that I absolutely love. It's not a conference approved. One of the girls I sponsor found it, and it's a Christian 12-step little daily book. You know, I are a Christian now. You know, it's just the way things go. I make fun of the Christians, but I are one. It's a little Christian book that has a scripture out of it, and then it ties up with the step for that day, and it's really magnificent. And I read those things. I don't get bogged down in reading too much because I used to have them all around me. I had Oral's books and Jimmy's books and Jim and Tammy's tapes and, you know, anything. I had it piled around me, and those were good for me, and I needed them. I've read them all, just read them all, and just had a lot of magnificent times with them. But for now, for quite some time, this is what I do in the morning. And I get up and I go on. There's a big difference in faith and trust in me in my prayer and meditation time. Faith, they talk about a lot in the big book, and faith is something I think I don't know what it is. You just know it's going to happen. And I, trust is more, I think, a word that I use and use it a lot rather than faith. My trust in this God and in prayer and the whole thing came in a simple little way. My trust came in the group. I walked into a group of people that I absolutely did not know and never seen before in my life. And y'all just, you had my immediate attention. You had my immediate trust. Now, isn't that amazing? As sick as I was when I walked into this very room, I mean, I trusted you. Now, that just doesn't make any sense to me. That has to be from something other than myself. From you, I've picked out that sponsor, and I trusted her. And I didn't believe a lot of things she told me, but I wanted her acceptance and her approval so desperately that I did anything she asked me. And the only thing she asked me was to do this program. She didn't ask me anything outside of it. And because I wanted her approval, and because I trusted her, I did what she asked me to do, and that was the step. I trusted her belief in God. I didn't have one, didn't believe there was one particularly, but she believed it, and I trusted her belief. And I used her for a long time, and then I used her God for a long time. And then I trusted these steps. I trusted what you said because it worked for you, and I was willing to go to any length. And then I had my own experience. Remember I told you, I sat there, I looked up the board, and it said, God as we understood him. And I thought, I can start from there. That was my first spiritual awakening. I trusted that you said when I took a four-step, something would happen. I did it. And there was that guy who looked into my soul. And then I trusted you that I could make these amends and it would work. And they did. So I've trusted you. I've had enough experiences now that I know. I have a little book that I've kept for many years. It's called My Miracle Book. It's one of these little cute ones, you know. It has a cute little cover, and you open it up to see what's in there. It's nothing. Just blank pages. And I call that my miracle book, and I write down these things. Many of you have had a miracle this weekend. And I write them down because I forget them. In 6 months, I think, well, I wonder if there is a God. You know, after all this stuff's happened to me, and anything bad happens, I blame it on God, and just silly stuff. So I have this little miracle book, and nothing's in there but miracles. It's absolutely the neatest thing in this world to read. I go back and I say, oh yeah, that did happen. Impossible things. When there is a situation that is totally and completely impossible, that's when God does it. And I forget that. So that's why I have to go to my miracle book and I say, oh yeah, this could not have happened. It was impossible. In God's green earth, this couldn't have happened. And look at there, it did. This is what happened. So my trust was built. This little story that my sponsor told me once, I just love it, about faith and trust. This man was a high wire walker, and he was going to do this real neat trick. He was going to get him a wheelbarrow, and he was going to go this inch cable over Niagara Falls. And his buddy went with him, said, oh, you can do that. You can do that. And the guy said, do you think I really can? Oh, yeah, man, I have all the faith in the world in you. You can push that thing over there and not make a bobble. And he went with him and just, you know, was really encouraging him. The news people came and the crowds gathered and they were just all around and the guy was real nervous. And his buddy said, hey, I have faith. You're going to make that. Don't you worry one second. He said, do you really trust me, the guy with the wheelbarrow? He said, sure, I know you can do it. He said, oh, good, would you get in? Mm-hmm. And that's the difference sometimes in faith and trust for me. I may have the faith, but by God, I ain't getting in. I'll watch you. I'll watch God. When there's absolutely no other way, no other way, and this side of Niagara Falls is going to fall into eternity, I might get in. Maybe. Kind of. Almost. So for me, it's had to be action. One more time, it's had to be action. It's having to build that trust. And to pray and meditate in the only way I know how. And I certainly can't tell you how to do that. There's just no way. It's your journey. And I think it's an exciting journey for all of us. And it's really, the longer I've done it, the more it's held me in good stead. BJ and I were talking about it yesterday. You know, what the things that we do here over and over, and she said it last night, that the most precious thing that she knows right now is that she knows it's going to be okay no matter what. And Debbie read some last night out of the AA's 12 and 12 on that 11th step where it says, you know, what we have here and what we do. In fact, I'm going to read a little bit of that. She didn't, because when times are bad, this is another thing that I go to. The 11th step, we discover that we do receive guidance for our lives just about the extent we start making demands on people to give it to us on our order and our terms. Almost every experienced AA and or Al-Anon will tell how his affairs have taken remarkable and unexpected turns for the better as he tried to improve his conscious contact with God. He will also report that at every season of grief or suffering, when the hand of God seemed heavy or even unjust, new lessons for living were learned, new resources of courage were uncovered, and that finally, inescapably, the conviction came that God does move in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. All this should be very encouraging news for those of you who recoil from prayer because they don't believe in it or because they feel themselves cut off from God's help and direction. All of us, without exception, pass through these times when we can only pray with the greatest exertion of will. Occasionally, we go even further than this. We are seized with a rebellion so sickening we simply won't pray. When these things happen, we should not think too ill of ourselves. We should simply resume prayer as soon as we can, doing what we know to be good for us. Perhaps one of the greatest rewards of meditation and prayer is a sense of belonging that comes to us. We no longer live in a completely hostile world. We are no longer lost and frightened and purposeless. The moment we catch even a glimpse of God's will, the moment we begin to see truth, justice, and love as the real and eternal things in life, we are no longer deeply disturbed by the seemingly evidence to the contrary that surrounds us in pure human affairs. We know that God lovingly watches over us. We know that when we turn to Him, all will be well with us here and hereafter. The seemingly bad, I think it's bad, but if I leave it alone, it's not so bad. Another of my sponsor's favorite story, there's the king, the kingdom, and he passed out these little pieces of material with directions to everybody in the kingdom. And he was going to have this giant, big, huge thing made that was going to be over his long court hall. And everybody was thrilled to death if you were chosen to do a piece. And this one lady got a piece, and it was just to be blue, just dark blue, nothing else. Her neighbor had sequins in hers and jewels and everything, and it just really made her mad. The seemingly bad thing was she got this yucky, and her friend was getting the real good stuff, and she didn't like it. So she snuck and got the stuff and made hers as pretty as her neighbor's. And then they come and gathered all this stuff up, and they took it, and they brought it, and they took it, and put it all together in the king's court. And he invited all these people, and was going to give them praise and honor, and give them some little something for doing their part. And when they got to the great hall, and the banquet was there, and they pulled back the curtain, here was this magnificent, magnificent thing. And it had the river and the mountains and this jewels and everything. And right up in the big middle of this giant blue sky was this ugly thing with sequins all over it. She'd screwed up the whole tapestry. Seemingly bad. She thought she had been put down. There's a jillion stories I could tell you about my 11th step and how and what I've done with it. But I think I'm going to tell you about my last year. As I told you, we wound up in California because we went broke. I didn't know, and it's still an amazing lesson for me, how a man and his finances are so hooked. It's like me and you and our kids. Me and you and our recipe box, you know. That's who we are. And a man and his business, his ability to make a living, to support his loved ones, is really who they are. And I just wasn't aware of that. I've heard about it, but I wasn't really aware of it. Husband, I got married. We'll be married 8 years pretty quick. I mean, I was rich for about 30 minutes, and honey, I loved it. Whoa, it was great. I'd been broke all my life. Well, then he had invested his life savings in a building that, I mean, in a business that he had in California. He sold all that, took all that money, and went back to Oklahoma and invested it back there right before the oil bust. And he lost everything, just everything. So we moved from there to Dallas trying to get it put together. And, of course, we couldn't, so we... And that took about 4, 5, 6 years there. And it was going downhill slowly each day, each week, each month, till we lost the home. We lost all the real estate. We lost the oil leases. We lost, you know, it's just a little bit of time. It was just like taking a big plug of his flesh out, just a big chunk of him all the time. And as those chunks went, he got a little testy. And as he got testy, I got testy. And we started having trouble. And the honeymoon was over. We started having trouble in our marriage. And I thought when you got married to a sober alcoholic, life was going to be wonderful. You didn't fuss, you know. And slowly, things started deteriorating. And we were not kind to each other. And then we moved to Dallas, and it didn't even get any better at all. And then he announced to me that we were going to California. And, oh, that he was, if I wanted to. And I called my sponsor, and I was just whining, carrying on. I don't want to. I'm not going to. I'll divorce him. I'm staying here. You know, I don't like him anyway. I'm fed up with him. She says, I don't think so. She said, why don't you let him go on out and you stay back there for a couple of months and let him get things put together and see and make sure that it's going to be all right. Cecil, that sounded great to me, and I went to him with the proposition, and he knew it almost sounded relieved. So he packed up his stuff, and I packed up my stuff, and we put some in storage, and we sold some, and, you know, it was just god-awful, sorting this pile over here and fixing that pile over here and packing it and unpacking it and selling it and getting his stuff for him and my stuff for me, and it just seemed like it went on forever. And I moved into my daughter's corner of her living room in a one-bedroom apartment with her and my three-year-old grandbaby. Her with, 4 years of sobriety, 3.5 years of sobriety, me with my wonderful Al-Anon, and we were looking excited. Thanks. We were real excited about it. Just me and her having fun, camping out. Oh, whoa. So he goes off, and I stay there. And at first I was really relieved, and it was kind of good, and it was kind of nice, and then I really started missing him. I missed his companionship. I missed him doing the little things. I missed my coffee. I missed him taking care of the car. I missed him jumping all over me if I forgot to call him, you know, if I was going to be late. I missed my husband. And I realized that, yes, I did want to be with him. So in June, he moved me out there. And in June, it was just a ripping away of my Texas that I love, my home, my family's back there. My daughter and my three-year-old granddaughter had intended to move out with us. And at the last minute, she just didn't feel welcome. She didn't feel it was the right time, and she just didn't go. And I was devastated. The only reason I really was going to go is because she and that baby were coming. That baby is my second chance. That baby's a lot of my life. And my daughter is, you know, she's busy in life, and I'm just quite sure if I wasn't there to take care of the baby, BJ, that, you know, who's going to take care of that baby? And I was just crushed when I left. And I got out to California, and he's a typical man. He is driving down the street, saw this apartment for rent side, and just wheeled in there and rented it, and it was about as big as this little podium. And we had a great time going out there. We rented this big, huge truck, and one of his sponsorees drove the truck out. One of my sponsorees, now this tells you how insane some of the people I sponsor is, and y'all really ought to have some pity on me when you hear some of this stuff that I have to put up with. Her name's Cindy and John, and they live in Billings, Montana. They drove from Billings, Montana to Oklahoma to help us leave from a conference that we were at. They helped us drive all the way to California. Cindy drove with me. John was in his little truck helping us carry my treasures. So here we caravaned, the three of us, out to California. And they were helping me try to get this stuff in this apartment as big as this podium. And I started crying. At that point, I started crying. There was just no place to put my stuff. I mean, this is my stuff. The only stuff that I have left in this, I can't say that word, this guy, you know, had screwed up my life anyway, and here's my stuff sitting out on this lawn. I didn't know what I was going to do with it. So we had to separate out there on the lawn. I was taking out stuff and putting it back in boxes, repacking and do it one more time to store it so I could get a place. And we were in that place till October. And this is June. He thought we was going to get out of there in July. We were stuck in there till October. And I begged off in October. And I found the place and we moved again in October. I was just getting settled in there. I was just getting, you know, things put up and done. And I, you know, the Al-Anon out there is, you know, not right. They don't do it right out there, you know. I have no support, and it's just, it's really strange. And the last of October, we got this phone call. My husband's brother, who was an alcoholic but sober in his church, could sing. God, he sang. He came to all the conferences that we had anything to do with and sang, and he just was my husband's favorite brother. He just dropped dead. He was singing at a podium on a Sunday night at a revival, and he started having chest pains and had a heart attack and died. So my husband had to borrow some money and fly back to Florida for the funeral. He got back, and 10 days later is when I got the call about my brother Jimmy's suicide. And I go through all that, and I see my mother, and I see all that stuff, and I see my son and his madness, and I come back, and while I'm there, my daughter decides that she misses me a lot, so she decides that she wants to move out. So we get the arrangements done while I'm back there, and I bring the baby back with me. And I get there on, I think it's Wednesday, and Thursday my house is going to be full of AA people for Thanksgiving dinner, and I do that. And then it's Christmas, and I hate Christmas. I was supposed to go back. It was my year to go back to Texas to be with my family. Of course, I can't because we've had all this money that we spent on funerals, and I mean, Christmas was not my family. It was just awful, and my marriage just stinks. I just don't like him. And someone talked about it last night, and I was so glad to hear it. You know, we were all in pain. Everybody was in their own individual pain. Jim couldn't comfort me, and I couldn't comfort him, and he was too needy, and I just didn't want him around me. And I was too needy, and he just didn't want me around him. And our marriage was just dead. And he was being so hateful to me, I couldn't tolerate it. And one day, right after Christmas, I said to him, I can't handle this, and I'm leaving. And if you'll give me time to get a job and get some money put together, I just need to leave. And that was fine with him. And in a few days, he came to me, and he said, we had talked about going to marriage counseling in Dallas. Are you still interested in that? And I said, yeah. And he said, the lady was a friend of his. Yeah, it was. And I suggested that maybe we ought to pick somebody else because he got mad. And I thought, well, talk to my sponsor about it. She said, well, go, because you just go and tell her. If she's a professional, she'll send you somewhere else. Now, this lady doesn't go to Al-Anon. She's married to an alcoholic. She thinks Al-Anons are pukey and boring, and she don't want anything to do with them. She goes to open AA meetings. She's not an alcoholic. And she's a therapist. And she works with us. So we go in and we sit down. And I've been stripped before, but I was stripped in that little hour. And it was like I'd cry, and she had a box of Kleenex over by her chair that she gives her clients when they cry. Wouldn't you do that? If it's your house, you have a box of Kleenex, and somebody's snotch dripping, you know, wouldn't you hand them a Kleenex? She didn't give me a Kleenex. She was totally on Jim's side, I promise you, and I'm not saying this out of prejudice. I mean, she was on his side. She kept referring to her husband and her daughter. Everything was brought up, and finally I said, you know, if we're basing this on experience, your experience, strength, and hope here, you don't have the same experience that we've got. Boy, and you can see hate fly across her face. I'm a professional. I said, well, good, let's get into profession then, and not your experience, because, you know, this is not right. And I really was ripped apart in that thing. And when we left there, we got up. Jim stood up. She hugged him. And she started out, and I took a step forward and had my arms up like this, and she walked right past me. And I was stripped. I thought, you witch. And we got out of there, and all I could think about was that. I mean, that was total rejection at the height. And she was sitting there saying we weren't going to make it. And the way we used to try is what she was saying. But if we did want to go home and write all this stuff down that we didn't like about each other and bring it back to her. And I told her I didn't want to come back to her and that what my sponsor had said. And, boy, that went over like a lead balloon. So when we got out of there, I said, did you notice that she didn't hug me? Well, he didn't know what I was talking about. And he had basically told her he was through, that there was anything that he could think of, there was no rewards in his marriage, and that he was through. And literally what he brought me there for that day was to hear it be said in that situation, I think, that he was through with me. And that was it. The marriage was dead. And it was okay. I was real sad and I was real hurt. It was okay. And I got home and he moved into the other bedroom. And it was just, that was it. I was hurt. I was crushed. And I thought, well, God is in control of my destiny. No man. And I went and I got this book. And I got my Bible. And I read what I was supposed to read, and I did what I was supposed to do. And I prayed and meditated like you would never believe. And I had to know that that marriage was dead. It was dead. And if it was ever brought back to life, it had nothing to do with me. It was not mine. And I remembered this one word that kept bothering me, and it was word commitment. Jim and I had made a commitment a long time ago that we were going to be married. No matter what, we was going to work through it. And that kept bothering me. When Jim and I first dated, he was so scared of me that he dumped me anyway. We dated, and I was supposed to move out and marry him out in California, and he got frightened and dumped me, and I didn't see him for nearly 2 years. And I was at a convention, and he came to that convention, and we saw each other again and got back together and got married. And I remembered that story. I thought, this is amazing to me. This seemingly bad thing is totally is impossible. This is an impossible situation. This is one of those that perhaps I better turn over to God. And hear my little story, because he knew he was having some trouble, and he said, "Boy, aren't you glad therapy didn't work?" And I said, "Oh, yes. The only thing we had left was the program. I mean, that's all we had left was the program. Therapy doesn't work for me. Therapy, they work up here, they have no earthly idea about impossible situations. They only have the slightest idea about miracles. They think and they work. Lord, I can't work on nothing. It just didn't work, and I had to go. The only thing that's ever worked for me is the program." So I admitted that I was powerless. And I knew that there was a power that was going to help me. Didn't matter anything else that would help me. And I dug into this 11th step. I mean, I dug into it. I was meditating, I was praying, and I was trusting, and I just kind of got okay with it. And I knew whatever came out of this seemingly bad thing, it was going to be the best for both of us. And a couple of weeks passed, and I was going to a convention to talk, and my husband came in there, and he was going to join me because he had to, because the convention paid for everything, and everybody expected us there, and he just came. And as I was going over earlier, it was like an hour drive, and he came in, and he gave me some money, and he stayed in my room that whole weekend, and he just hugged me and loved me and held on me. We got home Sunday night, and I went to bed, and he was in there, and I thought, I'm not going to wait and see if he goes. This bedroom's going to drive me nuts. And I went in there, and I said, "Jim, are you coming back to our bed?" And he said, "Yes. I love you, and I want to try this." And I said, "I love you. Thanks." And I don't know what happened. I have no earthly idea what happened, except this seemingly bad thing I turned over the only way I know how to turn it over. I want you to know that we're just like we were when I first met him. We're holding on each other. We're hugging each other. We're loving each other. I respect him. I'm looking at him, and I think, he ain't got as old as I thought he'd gotten. And he's tender and he's sweet, and I'm tender and he's sweet. You know what I was told to do during that time? Be light and polite, no meaningful conversation. And we started from that, being light and polite, no meaningful conversation. Again, we were courteous to each other. We respected each other. And God has put this thing back together. It's much sweeter. It's much wonderful. It's like it should be, I guess, between a man and a woman. We have released each other. We love each other. And I'm just enjoying it for today. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps I've tried to share with you, it says in here that we take this message to others. This message, my message that I've tried to share with you, is having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. It's the result of the steps, period. I have nothing else to give anybody, anytime, anywhere. It's the result of these steps. It's what's happened to me. It's my marvelous story. It says in here that we try to practice these principles in all of our affairs. I try to practice it in my marriage, as I told you. I try to practice it as a daughter. I try to practice these affairs with my children, my group, in all my affairs. And it's not easy to do this, is it? We used to do a long time ago a thing called a 12-step call. Long time ago. Y'all remember that, BJ? 12-step calls. God, they were marvelous. They were magnificent. It's like you find a pot of gold anymore. If somebody says you won't go 12-step call, we kill to get on it. So many people think a 12-step call today is asking about their insurance and driving them over to the hospital. Unfortunately, that's a 12-step call these days. Let me tell you what they used to be like. We'd get a call and they'd say, "Vinoy, I've got this drunk, and he's got a wife over there. Can you get some gals and come and meet us over there?" I'd say, "You bet. You bet." And I'd call some girls, and we'd go over there, and we'd take the woman and or the husband and or the kids into the kitchen. You know, we always get in the kitchen. You know, Alan's always hit the kitchen. And we'd sit there, and we'd talk to them, and we'd tell them what we were doing down at the group. And I'd say what happened to me, and should Marianne say what happened to her and Pat say what happened to her? And as the book says, we would see some light come into some very tired old eyes. They, you know, I sat in somebody's building and they told me about this thing. They told me about it and they said, come go with us. And I went with them and they held my hand. God, it used to be so wonderful. It was so magnificent to be able to go on a 12-step call. God, I loved it. And what we now call a 12-step call is, let me see your insurance card. Unfortunately, from time to time you might get the opportunity. If you get the opportunity, this is how you can get it. You can call your central office if you have one. You can call AA's number if you have one. And you might tell them, hey, if you ever have an Al-Anon call, would you call me? Give me a chance. God, try it. You just can't imagine how magnificent it is. It's wonderful. We have volunteers who answer the central office phone. Dallas, they said, take the tapes. I don't know what that meant, but after the central office closed, they have a little recording. If you need some help, call this number. And we put our names and telephone numbers on there and people could call us. It's just great. Number one, the first part of this is having had a spiritual awakening. It doesn't say, sure hope you have one, folks. And possibly you might have. We sure hope you do. It says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. So you know you're going to get it, don't you? I mean, is that a promise? Is that exciting or what? Period. That's all it says. Second part says, carry the message to others. We tried to carry this message to others. How do you carry your message? You know the most important one you do for me, and I told you about it a long time ago, sitting in your chair on your committed meeting, on your committed home group, week after week after week. Boy, you carry me a message. You carry me a message that's working and you need it and you change and you love it. And it's, God, I love that. Please don't ever stop doing that for me. Please don't. How many of you, I don't want to know the answer, but just think about it. How many of you in your group have people with more than 10 years sitting in your group? Isn't it interesting? It's really interesting. 10 years or more. It's really interesting how many is there. I don't know where they go. But let me tell you, I'm here. And you're going to see me every Thursday night in my chair. And don't you get my chair. You're going to see me Monday night in my chair. Wednesday night, the big AA meeting, I'm sitting by my husband and we're recovering for our disease in our chairs. We're there. That's a huge message to carry. I carry the message by going on 12-step calls when they call me. I carry the message by going and sitting up the room. And we have one key that we have. We've got a $25 deposit on it. So that's the most important message that we carry in my group. You, the key carrier, better be there on time and have the key. That's a real message. Shirley did a real message. She carried a message. She stood up here and she took all the flack. And, you know, there's a lot of flack. Can you imagine how we whine and complain? I was in Palm Springs, California. And you know how famous that place is. You know, it's just a luxury joint. And I was in this fancy dance. Just a few weeks ago, I'll tell you how wonderful you got as a speaker up here this morning. It's this grand hotel. I mean, this foo-foo stuff is just everywhere. It's just everywhere. And they didn't have me registered, and I didn't have a room, and they took me to the wrong room, and I'm sitting there just, and I thought, good Lord, girl, get a grip. I mean, you're in Palm Springs, California. You're not Lubbock County out there in front of the bar wondering who's going to come out that you can grab. I mean, and I'm complaining. And I find myself doing that over and over and over. Now, what kind of message was I carrying this bellhop that I was just eating his butt up and all he was doing was carrying my luggage, you know? I have a favorite story about carrying the message. Oh, I'm way over. My a girl in Norman, Oklahoma. Big, tall gal. Just so big. I mean, she makes me look like a minner. And she hugged like them Christians. You know, she hugged you and you just... And people literally kind of run from her. You don't think, oh, no. Just like a football player. And she was not... she was slow. Just not, you know, just slow. Just a wonderful, sweet gal, and she was slow. She had the same job for like 17 years of passing a salad from this refrigerator to the line. This refrigerator to the line. And that's what she did. And she loved doing that. And she came in, and she was looking for a sponsor, and everybody was... And she came over, and she asked me to be her sponsor, and I thought, oh, Jimmy Crickets, you know. And I said, yes, you know, I'm trying to look enthusiastic, you know. And God, what a joy. What a treat. She is the most magnificent gal you've ever seen in your life. She and I just had a hell of a trip on these steps. She couldn't read too well, so we read together. Started me all over. She couldn't drive, so we got a private tutor, and she now has her own driver's license. My girls picked her up once a week and took her to the meeting and brought her back. And she now just, she'll kill you if you try to take some newcomer home or pick them up. That's her job, thanks. But one of the things that I always ask my brand new girls do to feel a part of is what they ask me to do. When the meeting's over, pick up the cups, clean up the room, take the ashtrays, rinse them out. And she got to doing that. Boy, she's loved it. I mean, it made her feel a part of like that. Well, I noticed once that she was still doing that, and I had some other girls, and I went over to her. I said, hey, you don't have to do that anymore. We've got these other girls. They can do that. She said, oh, wait a minute. She said, you know, I can't talk too well. And I can't read that stuff and do like y'all can do. She said, I can really pick up these cups, and I can straighten the room up. She said, can this be my deal? I said, you got it, honey. And that's like probably 6 years ago, and I guarantee you, if you go there, tomorrow night she'll be in it. That's her room, and don't you mess up too bad. It's the sweetest message I've ever seen. It's the sweetest thing I've ever seen, is this girl getting newcomers, driving them, and taking them home and cleaning up the room so you're going to be comfortable. Now, that's a better message than I've done all weekend. It's a better message than most of you've been doing here. She just cleans up the room, and it's a joy to her. It's just an absolute, she's just a magnificent gal. I just wouldn't trade her for anything. Somebody would like to show her how she does it. Practice these principles in all our affairs. What are the principles? I sat in a meeting one time, and I've been around a long time, and they read that, and I thought, gosh, I wonder what the principles are. You go ask everybody, and everybody's going to tell you, well, of course I know what they are. They're this and this and this and this. They're not written anywhere. And everybody has their own idea. And the thing that comes to me when you talk about principles, the first thing I think about, the principles of this program, is dignity. Respect. Honoring your commitment. Doing what you're supposed to do. That's what I think of. And a lot of people have a lot of different ideas, and there's a lot of things written on them, but that's what I think they are. And being, we used to have a thing a long time ago that says, you may be the only big book anybody sees, so do it. You know, live it. And I believe that. I think I should, this, in all my affairs, at work, down the street, in the hotel at Palm Springs, for criminy sakes, everywhere. And this was a real good lesson to me once. Two good lessons I'll share with you, then I'm going to hush. One was one time I got to the clubhouse early, and this woman came in, she's brand new, and I sat there and I visited with her a long time, and she was just so desperate. She had this bad, violent drunk at home, and I was told her all the things that we tell. Told her about the joy and the love that's here and the trust and the beauty, and just went on and on and on. And so she was going to stay for the meeting, and in a few minutes this lady came in, sat down at the other end of the room, and she turned to me and she said, does she belong here in this group? And I said, yeah. She said, I don't want any part of it. And she got up and left. And unfortunately, I didn't get a telephone number. I didn't do anything. And I mean, she would not stop. She just bolted out of there. And I was stunned. I hope that the principles that I shared out on that street, that nobody walks in and sees me walk into my Al-Anon group and walks out. Yeah, there's no telling what that is. Well, I kind of had an idea what that old what that gal was doing, because she didn't care the principles. She just didn't. She just came to our group and stirred up the crap. You know, she just never did get well. Last I heard, she's still stirring. Another thing. I was going down the street, and I was in a hurry. It wasn't in L.A. It was in Lubbock County, which, you know, it's not rush hours, you know, like up here in McKenzie Bridge. You know, it's just rush hour. And I was trying to get to where I was going, and, you know, and I was in a hurry, and this idiot was just in, cut me off. Just made me so mad, so I'll go around and look at him just square in the face. And I drive on a few blocks, and I pull into the Al-Anon lot and get out, and guess who pulled up right beside me? In all my affairs, I have these listed. These are my affairs, and they're listed in the big book too, if you ever have time to pick it up and look at it. The thing that I need to practice these 12 steps, these principles are with, as a daughter, a wife, a sister, a mom, an Al-Anon member, a worker, a shopper, a driver, a sponsor, a sponsoree, with my checkbook, with his checkbook, and on and on and on. The list of my affairs goes a long, long way. Having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, I am thrilled that you let me share this with you. This is what keeps me going. This is my message.